It's Abu here. You're probably wondering, what's different around here? And the answer is everything. I took the last year off, not just from podcasting, but from everything. I needed a reset. Last year was one of the hardest years of my life. And as you know, life doesn't just throw one thing at a time at you. It hits you with everything all at once. I hit a mental roadblock, my business hit a wall, and then I faced an unimaginable loss of someone I deeply loved. I had a reset. I went deep, asking myself, what's wrong with me? What did I do to deserve this? I struggled with grief, with loss, with relationships, with business, and family. I was operating from a place of seeking permission. Permission to let go, permission to step back, permission to prioritize myself. And then it hit me. You don't need anyone's approval to take the next step. You don't need permission to be a CEO. But you do need the tools, the mindset, and the support to lead in a way that doesn't cost you your peace. It took me over a decade to truly figure this out. And now I'm ready to keep going, sharing what's worked, what hasn't, and everything I'm still learning along the way. So if you're ready, and I know I am, hit subscribe, leave a review, and share this with someone who needs to hear it. Because this isn't just my journey, it's ours. Lastly, I just want to thank everyone that reached out to me over the last year just to check on me, make sure I was doing good. I truly appreciate the support, and I look forward to continue building more deep connections with you all. This is the Powered AF Podcast, a show about visionaries, high performers, and entrepreneurs, and their stories on how they push past fear, overcome imposter syndrome, and navigate through the mental roadblocks in order to achieve the highest level of success. And I'm your host, Abu Fofana. In this week's episode, we're going to sit down and interview Savitra Wilson. Now, I'm super excited about this episode because there's a lot of gems that she talks about. We talk about how she bootstrapped her first business to seven figures and then invested in her second business and then raised over, you know, eight figures for that business. So we talk about bootstrapping, venture capital. We also talk about government contracting and the big opportunity there. Something I do want to point out is during the time of this recording with Savitra, we do touch upon in the beginning of the episode, Hurricane Ida. So hurricane that just passed through the East Coast affecting a lot of cities and towns. And Savitra is from New Orleans, Louisiana. And so there's a lot of history with, you know, Hurricane Katrina and so much other things that have gone on. So we touch upon that and just how's she doing? How are the people doing? How we could help and so forth. So I'm super excited about this episode because it has a lot of range. And for those of you that don't know Savitra Wilson, you will want to get to know who she is. So without further ado, let's welcome Savitra Wilson. Just to give you a background, you know, this is the Powered AF podcast, and AF stands for Abu Fofana. I know some people got, cuss words and all that stuff, but
it's crazy because the first thing I thought was, but I get it. Thank you for the clarification. I should have known better.
No, everyone think, I mean, yeah, I'm not as famous yet, but one of these days, but in this podcast, you know, and the reason why I wanted to interview you, Savitra, outside of, you know, your greatness and, you know, greatness precedes you, is because I think there's a lot of people that could resonate with your story, how you came to where you are, and also just the many lives you've lived, you know, from being a bootstrapper to raising VC to being a leader in your community as well. So I think you have a lot to say. And so welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So before we get started, how are you? Like, how are you actually feeling?
I woke up the other day and I was actually feeling angry. I went through these different stages of emotions over the past week because I'm from Louisiana. I live in New Orleans, although I split my time between New Orleans and New York. The majority of the time I'm in New Orleans. And of course, we were recently hit by Hurricane Ida, which did tons of damage and flooding across the South Louisiana area. And even in New Jersey and New York, you know, they got slammed by Hurricane Ida as well. And so when the hurricane was coming, I was like, okay, I'm hopeful. You know, I'm really hopeful. And New Orleans actually didn't take on a lot of flooding, but other cities around us did, like complete disaster zones, homes gone, people who can't return to their homes today. We had a complete power outage in New Orleans and other cities. And so I don't know if anyone's ever lived through the experience of having your entire city go black and staying black for days. That was what happened in New Orleans and what is still happening in other cities in Louisiana right now.
And this is sort of reminiscent of like Hurricane Katrina, because how long ago did that happen?
So Hurricane Katrina, ironically, the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina was the same day that Hurricane Ida hit, the 16th anniversary. So same day, exact same day. And so the difference is, you know, the media has this love affair with New Orleans. And so because New Orleans didn't flood, they didn't really give it as much coverage. You know, they wanted to see people on top of their roofs. They wanted to see people dead. Let's be real. They wanted to see Kanye West saying, you know, George Bush don't care about black people. They wanted the good stuff, right? And because they didn't get that, they didn't cover areas where people are really distraught.
And when this was happening, I remember when Hurricane Katrina came and Hurricane Ida that just passed, there's been a lot of development and progress that's occurred. So was the impact as great as, you know, Hurricane Katrina, or were there better things in place this time around to sort of save more lives and so not a lives get lost?
Yes. And so I will say that one of the reasons why I was hopeful, particularly for New Orleans, is that after Katrina, everyone knows that the levees broke, right? Spike Lee did a whole documentary on it for HBO, when the levees broke. And the Army Corps engineers came in and they built new levees. And they built one of the most sophisticated storm systems in the entire world in New Orleans. And so, you know, Hurricane Ida's come in. It's bigger than Katrina. It's too late to call a mandatory evacuation, right? Because the storm developed so quickly, they could not call a mandatory evacuation. So there's a lot of reasons why you can't do that. So if you don't have enough time, you don't have enough time to get gas, you end up putting hundreds of thousands and millions of people on the roads, and then they end up getting stuck on the road. So you couldn't call a mandatory evacuation. And so the difference, though, is that New Orleans didn't flood, and it didn't flood because of the system that was built. So, people, it works. And we need one of these systems, as I was telling you, all across the East Coast, the Gulf. We need to hurricane-proof our cities.
Right. And I completely agree with you, especially sometimes you question, like, where does all our tax dollars go? Right. Like, where is it going if we're spending all this money? But when we have these natural disasters, it almost feels like third world country. Right. Like,
oh, yes.
And help isn't being given, and not enough help and resources is moving quickly enough. And we rave about the supply chain of Amazon and Walmart. But like, right. You know, how do we, you know, prepare for these natural disasters that happen? And I almost feel like we also play a part in it because we're unprepared every single
time. We're unprepared. We also play a part in climate change, right? So the natural warming of, not even natural, like human-made disaster, right? So some of the things that we're seeing is definitely human-made. And so we have to do our part. But yeah, it's also holding like governments accountable as well, because we're not in a third world country and we don't pay third world bills. Right. And that's the key. People are like, oh, you guys are privileged. You know, most third world countries don't even have power for the majority of the day. And that's correct. But we also pay first. You know, you want to see my electricity? I expect this stuff to work.
Right. No, it's good that, you know, and again, I wanted to figure out where you were mentally, right? I know, you know, this is still new. This is still recent. And just to make sure I check up on you, because there's a lot of people listening in, maybe they were affected, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, I always try to make sure that, you know, we're as current as possible. Now, in your own words, and, you know, I know I glanced over the greatness of Savitra. In your own words, you know, who are you? How do you describe yourself?
So I would say I describe myself as definitely a serial entrepreneur. I am a Southern girl. And that's something that you can't take out of me. I am a person that loves my family and that is very loyal to the people around me and trying to like support others and see everybody win, right? So, because it's not fun if you're at the top by yourself.
Right, right, right. And I know she's very humble. Very humble. And so, you know, let the people know you're a CEO, right? You're a CEO. I know they see it when they're watching this video, like, wow, that's Vitra Wilson right there. And so what's your business currently and what does it do?
Yeah. So to talk a little bit about myself here for a second, you know, I started my first business in 2009, Solid Ground Innovations. That was a strategic communications and management agency, built that to, you know, 7-figure company. And saw there was opportunity to use tech to essentially productize some of our services. And today that has allowed me to run a tech company called Resilia. And we're a SaaS technology platform working across a two-sided market. On one side, we support nonprofit organizations and vendors, helping bring them day-to-day capacity through our software. And on the other side, we support funders. So everyone from corporations, private foundations, charities, you name it. If you give money, we're there to help support and manage where that money goes and how you support people with it.
So you just said a lot there. You said, okay, I built a 7-figure business and then I built another 7-8-figure business. And so when you were starting your first business, what was that like? The first business, did you raise funds or did you build that company?
So my first business, Solid Ground Innovations, I bootstrapped.
Okay.
We basically, you know, I was 22. I was like, you know, when you're 22, you're kind of naive because you just don't know what you don't know. But sometimes that can be a good thing because nothing blocks you, right? Mm. And so you don't feel, or I didn't have that pressure of like, I was going to fail or I was going to lose everything around me because I didn't have you know, a family, you know, kids to raise, all these things. So I didn't have that pressure. But I was able to execute on services that I felt that I could efficiently provide to customers. And some of our first clients were like attorneys. And so you think back in the day when I started my company now over 10 years ago, I was like, okay, attorneys have these old gaudy billboards, you know, they're not on social media.
Right, right.
And so I was like, let me come in, redesign your websites, do your digital media, your social media. And I packaged that in a retainer and I just started selling it to like law firms.
Wow.
And then from there, we expanded our customer base to corporations. One of the game changing contracts that I received was with Aetna. So obviously Fortune 10 company, they ended up selecting our company over all these other agencies. They were much bigger than us. And the reason they did was because we were in the community and they felt our presence in the community and they wanted to be in the community.
How old were you at this time when you started this?
So I started my company at 22, but we didn't really start to grow until I was probably about 25, 26.
But around this time, are you just graduating college at
22? I just graduated college.
So you decided to admit going into the workforce and like, you know, work in a...
Just dive in.
Okay.
You know, and I know people are like, well, that's so easy said, you know, like to say it than done. But I really just felt I didn't have any barriers, right, around me. And so, you know, my mom had actually just passed away. So I launched my company about 5 months after my mother passed away of cancer. And I always say that I think that that was like the push that I needed to like really go out and do something.
Yeah.
And also I had like really focused in college about just like going out and being successful because I wanted to help my mother, right? I wanted to give her, afford her the opportunities that I felt that she didn't have. Because she sacrificed so much to ensure that we could go off and do something with ourselves.
Right.
And so I wanted to give that back to her. And so when she passed away unexpectedly, for me, it was like, okay, well, now why am I working this hard for? Like, if I can't take care of my mom or retire my mom, right, then why am I working this hard?
Right.
And so I started from there. I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? How do I create and build a legacy? How do I employ people to do things that they love to do every single day? And so I definitely became more like outward facing around like, how do I help other people? And that is definitely like the foundation of my first business.
Were you and your mom pretty close?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We were very close.
Was she also an entrepreneur?
She was not. I'm when I look at my siblings, I am the entrepreneur. But my father was entrepreneur, and he also passed away when I was really young. But I do feel, always say that I have the business mind and acumen of my dad, but the heart of my mother.
So where did you learn how to do this, right? Everyone's looking like, well,
trial and error. And some mentors along the way.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And so would you say there was no one immediately in your family that you were learning, or you weren't taking over the reins of a family business?
No.
You were doing this from scratch, and your
Absolutely.
Purpose was trying to take care of your mom in
yeah.
the beginning.
Absolutely. So you have to realize, you know, I'm a first generation college student. When I went off to college, my mom was making about $28,000 as assistant manager at Kmart, right? My dad had passed away at this point. And so I went to LSU on a full Pell Grant, right? And so when I, you know, when you come from a family that like is so supportive of you and loving, you don't realize like, dang, we don't have a lot of money until you see that fast before. You're like, oh man, like how are we living like this? How are we even making it every day?
Right.
But as Black mothers do, they make a way. And so I think that is true to like my mother and kind of what she passed along to me. But no, I didn't have anyone that was showing me how to do it. I was like, this is something I want to do and I'm going to figure it out.
And so because you knew that, okay, we don't have money, did you know you had to work really hard in school to get a full ride? Was that like the only option at that point?
Well, in high school, when it became very apparent that my mom was going to pay for my tuition, I did. You know, I was in my counselor's office like, all right, what about these scholarships? And I ended up getting the Bill and Melinda Gates Scholarship, which is a huge scholarship for anyone who's ever received it. And I have to credit my band teacher because the letter that she wrote made me stand out.
Wow. Band.
My band teacher. Shout out to Miss Weatherly.
Wait, what instrument did you play in band?
Clarinet, but really any woodwind. I can play piano.
What? I'm good with the recorder. Hot cross buns. Like.
Exactly. That's how you start. Gotta start somewhere.
And so what would you say then was your relationship with the money? You know, you didn't grow up in a household where it was like around and, you know, you weren't taught about it. Like, how do you then go when you build a seven-figure business for your first business right away?
So I think that I had a very interesting relationship with money and finances in general because I watched my mother like just struggle financially, right? And I also watched her go into very deep debt trying to provide for her kids, right? So maxing out cars, doing this, doing that, just trying to provide for her family. And so I was always conscious of that when I went on to college. But, you know, I'll be the first one to tell you, I didn't blew some money, right? Like, thinking back, man, I should have did this with that FAFSA check. I should have did this with that, you know, with that refund check. And I didn't, right? I was living, you know, I was living in a world where I didn't realize how to properly invest or put away money or the things that I could have been doing with the money that I was getting. But I learned fast.
So you're in college, you're figuring this out. What made you decide that, okay, entrepreneurship is the route versus were you looking at other jobs, other companies? Like what made you make that decision ultimately?
Yeah, so I was in grad school and I actually was going down a path to actually become a professor, so a history professor.
Wow,
but
I did not know this.
I know, it's crazy. People are like, history professor, what in the world? That's so boring. But I also had a degree in journalism. So I was like, oh, I'm going to be a history professor, an academic. And then I also wanted to do film, right? So historical film documentary, like that. I wanted to get into that. And so that was like actually the path that I was taking right out of undergrad. And then I started working for a nonprofit called CASA, Court Appointed Special Advocates. And through that work, it opened up me to other opportunities based on the campaigns that we were doing. And so that also allowed me to enter a space where people began to reach out to me because they saw my work. And they're like, hey, can you consult us on this? Or can you consult us on that? And what happened was is that CASA, Court Appointed Special Advocates for Children, they were having issues getting Black male volunteers. So the majority of CASA foster children were Black males, Black boys, but the majority of their volunteers were actually white women. Mm. And so I was like, well, let me run this campaign. And I created this campaign. I went to LSU undergrad, and this is when LSU was like dominating sports, right? Yeah. We were like doing, we were everywhere. Basketball, football, we were dominating. And group of like my friends and others had just left and went to the NBA, NFL. And I asked one of my friends who had just got drafted number 4 overall in the NBA to be the face of the campaign along with his mother. And in doing that, it opened me up to an entirely new network. Mm. And through that network, people began to ask me to consult them on their projects.
So, you know, and I think people, and I want to lay this foundation down to people, is that you weren't taught any of this.
No.
You're putting yourself out there every single time, and you're sort of figuring it out. You're seeing a problem and you're saying, okay, well, we need more male volunteers. Okay, well, why don't I create a campaign? Let me tap back into my relationships and network that I have, and let me go from there.
Yeah.
And so at any point, did you think that, okay, well, maybe I'm too young to do this? Or, you know, did you have any imposter syndrome as you tried to be successful so early? And even this small camp, like this campaign that was ahead of mm-hmm. you, how did you navigate that? And did you have any imposter syndrome during that time?
So I don't think I had imposter syndrome, but I think I was frustrated a lot because I was young, because I was a woman, because I was Black, right? And I knew that some of the things, opportunities that I wasn't getting was because of those things. And so it wasn't that I felt that I had imposter syndrome. I felt that I can do this and I'm not getting these opportunities because of X, Y, and Z. Or then when I did get the opportunities, right, I'm like, oh, I want bigger opportunities and so on and so forth. But I think early in my journey, I think I'm very visible today, but I wasn't when I started my career and when I started my first business. And when people ask me, you know, how have you been so successful? It's very simple. I help other people win. Mm. And I helped a lot of other people win. Mm. Right. And so from that angle, because I'm behind the scenes,
right,
it's kind of harder to have imposter syndrome because I'm not so in the front, right? Someone else was, and I was like powering them.
What was your mindset around this? Because you're talking about being a cheerleader to other people. You're talking about not worrying about who gets the credit.
Right.
Right. So right. How do you even, and that this is the hardest thing that some people don't ever learn this.
Yeah. Right?
Some people yeah. don't ever learn this. And so why was it important for you to get the credit, to get the recognition, to be in the front page of the newspaper? Like, why wasn't that just as important to you?
I mean, you know, when I think about where I started, it was about solving a problem. And that's what I was hired to do. That's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to be a problem solver, and I wanted people to come to me to solve problems. And when I think about, oh, who gets credit for it? I have clients. They should get the credit for it, mm-hmm. right? Because that's who we're lifting up. And I think that oftentimes, even people who have like clients or whomever, they're sometimes they can be in conflict, right? Because they are so focused on like, how do they build themselves up? When in actuality, by building someone else up, it will build them up right. ultimately.
What she's saying, and she's dropping a lot of gems, and I want to make sure you guys are catching that. And it's important that, you know, in order to, that, like that cliche, the old quote, you know, in order to go far, you know, go together.
Yeah.
And I think in our minds, especially neighborhoods we grew up in, I grew up in, it's like, no, you go alone. But that's yeah. what you're taught, right? You're taught, no, you go alone. But in reality, in order to get further ahead, you have to actually go together. So that's really good that you learned that at such a young age. But I don't think a lot of people know that, right?
Yeah. And let me tell you, I'm a solo founder. So I went alone at it too, a lot. And I'm also a believer of, oh, if nobody's around me to go with me, I'm not going to stay here either. If I got to go alone, I'm going to go alone too. However, the more people I can bring along with me, and then also how can I prepare people and build people around me is important.
So you have that success in the campaign. Now are you thinking, okay, well, let me completely, because you were this was one of your clients, right? Mm-hmm. Were you now thinking, let me go start my second business? Like, you were having all this success. Why would you all of a sudden not do this business anymore and start a completely new business?
Yes. And so Abu asked me if I ever had imposter syndrome, not necessarily that, but definitely fear of failure. Mm. And so when I decided to start my second company, you're right, my first business was doing so well that people didn't get it. They were like, why are you about to go spend time doing this other thing? You need to continue to just grow this thing in front of you. And what I realized is a couple of things. One, I have been exposed to tech and I was like, oh, this is where it's at. Mm. And I want to create something disruptive and I want to create something that scales. And I think I have opportunity here to do that if I can put together the pieces, because I wasn't technical. I wasn't a technical founder, so I couldn't build it. I had to get someone else to build my vision. And so I branched out to do that because I felt like I could do something bigger and I wanted to do something that was bigger.
Wasn't that scary? Like you just mentioned, you didn't have the technical aspect, but you wanted to build tech. And then you had this other thing that was working really well. Wasn't that scary to, you know, now put more of your attention and focus in an area that it wasn't your strength?
Yeah, I think that even through the journey, many times I look back and was like, oh, did I do the right thing? Because I had invested so much of the money that I made from my first business into this other company because nobody was writing me checks. And if you know, if you're building a scalable company, eventually you might have to raise capital. So I'm going from a bootstrap company that I'm used to now having to raise capital for a company that originally and early on, people didn't necessarily believe in it. Mm. And so I'm taking money that I had made from the successful company and I'm just like pouring it into this idea and this tech company that really isn't moving at all, you know, early on, but I just believe in it that much. And then at times I'm like, man, I could have did so much other stuff with this money.
Right.
But I believed it and I kept at it. And one thing that I feel like I'm really good at is putting together teams. And I think that when you think about strong leaders and becoming a strong leader, it's like, can you be the visionary? And then can you go get people and hire people and find people that believe in your vision so much that they're going to come and work for you and help you build that thing?
So because you didn't have the technical aspect, you went and you built the team around to help you get to the finish line.
Yes.
Okay. And then while you're...
Are we ever at the finish line?
No, we're never at the finish line. No. The answer is no. And so as you're building this new thing, where does the idea come about raising? Because you're taking money from one idea that was successful. You're putting money into another company. When did you know you would have to raise? And how did you even go about raising? Because that's not what you did for your first company.
Right. It's not. So how did I know?
Yeah.
Probably after the first $1 million I took out of my pocket. So you got to realize, first generation college student, my mom made about $28,000 a year as a single mother, you know, couldn't afford to put us through college, had to make our own way. All my siblings either made their own way to college or they went to the military. And so I'd never seen money like this. So to have made money from nothing and then to take that money and then reinvest it into an idea is a very scary thing, right? Yeah. And everybody ain't built to do all that, you know? Some people will take that money and do something else with it.
They're not built to do that.
And so I think for me, I really did believe in this idea. And I also felt that, you know, I just had this belief like, oh, if I lose it, I'll make it again. I made it once, I'll make it again. And so I think that that is what kind of led me on that path to tech, even though I didn't have necessarily like this background in tech and this ability to do it. But I knew I needed to raise because it's high growth, scalable company. You know, when you think about, do you need to raise capital for a company? Can this company reach $1 billion valuation? Can this company reach 100 million annual recurring revenue? These are the things that you think about when you go out to raise venture capital. Right. And by the time that I invested X amount of money, I knew I could not invest no more of my money. One. Secondly, it wasn't feasible for me to do so because we needed to go to market. We need to hire very expensive engineers and to build software. And you're generally building ahead of revenue. And so these are some of the things and reasons why I went out to raise capital.
So you went from doing a campaign to now you're in this VC world that you know nothing about. So are you reading books? Like, how are you now closing the gap between where you want to go and catching up to that person that you need to be? How are you closing that gap? Was it through mentorship? What specifically did you do to help you get there a lot quicker?
Yeah, so I started becoming a part of other groups, right? So we talk about, oh, finding your tribe and doing these other things. When you are interested in a sector or space that you're not used to, you will certainly want to put yourself in an environment where people have been there or done that, or are also doing the same thing or trying to get to the same place as you are. And so, you know, in New Orleans, there's this place called Idea Village, was kind of like a hub, right, for early stage startups. I started going to conferences, right, around startups. You know, everybody picks up The Lean Startup, which is a book that everybody's like, oh, everybody got to pick up this book, The Lean Startup, they tell you. And you kind of figure it out from there, right? And I think some of it is trial and error, but the world that we live in today, there can be a lot less error, I feel like, than when I first started, because there's so many different blueprints that just weren't necessarily accessible back then, when I started, that are today. Even Twitter, right? When you think about like the VC community and the tech community, they're on Twitter.
Correct.
So go find them and follow them on Twitter, because they are always dropping gems. Some things you want to listen to, some things you don't. But they are there. And if you want to find the who's who in the tech ecosystem, go on Twitter.
No, and I think that's a really great resource for people. And you referenced it again. You didn't do it alone, right? Like, you found other community. Now, you built the company. You're the CEO, right? Yeah. The solo founder. But you hired the right team, right? That was your skill set, your superpower. You then joined other communities to see people that were already doing what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. So you were able to put yourself out there, although this thing looks scary, because for most people, they'd look at it and they'd be like, you know what, maybe I'll just go back, you know, to the thing that is successful already.
Right, my comfort zone.
Your comfort zone. And so as you're, you know, building this successful business, you talked about you built it to seven figures. You come from a household, y'all didn't have money. So what was that like when you, you know, made $1 million, mm-hmm. and here you are, you're in your 20s.
Yeah.
You made $1 million. And what was that feeling like when you saw that you had made $1 million outside of taxes?
It's kind of crazy, because I think now we think about it more like, oh, I just want to make $1 million. I want to see like $1 million in my account. But when I didn't really think about it, right? Because I just felt like, oh, this is just something. When you're in the motions, right, of just working and working and working, it happens. And then you all in many ways already got plans for it, right? Mm. And so you're right. Like, all right, I'm going to do this and this and this. I'm going to invest it. But I'll never let $1 million just sit, right? Unless I got about $100 million. But I like investing. I like, you know, investing in myself. I like investing in other founders. I like doing things with the capital that I have. So I don't think there was necessarily like a feeling of like, oh, wow.
You didn't think you had, you like,
kind of in this joint.
If I hit $1 million, right. You go down to, you know, the strip, you buy whatever you want, you know. And I remember listening to this one podcast, and they were interviewing the CEO of Slack. And he was talking about like the three levels of wealth in his eyes. He's like, the first level of wealth is you could go to a restaurant, you could order anything. You don't got to look at the menu, right?
Oh, that feel good. That's a good level. I ain't gonna lie. That level, that's real.
That's a real level, right?
It is.
You said the second level of wealth is when you don't have to worry about like your mortgage or rent. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you could pay it. Like, you're not really worried about that. And then he said the third level of wealth is you could plan a $40,000, $100,000 vacation the day before. And I was like, wait a second.
I'm trying to get to that third level.
I'm like, this is different. And so, you know, for me, like, it was when I was eating at a restaurant and I didn't have to look at the price. Like, to me, I was like, oh my God. Like, the waiter came around and she's like, oh, or how special and it costs. I was like, don't even tell me. Just,
yeah. Or being able to pick up the tab for the entire table.
Correct.
Right? And not even think about it. People are like, oh, no, I don't know. You're good.
Yeah. And I think that's where, for me, it allowed me to see, because similar to you, growing up, money wasn't really talked about in my household. So being able to do that, it's like, wow, like, well, here I am. Like, this is something I was striving to do, was to make impact and take care of the people around me. And, you know, capital is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, what was your relationship like at that point with money? Did you feel like you were good money manager at that point while you were making this capital, or were you working so much that you didn't even have the time to spend it?
So the thing about it, my first business when I was making the money, right? When I began to see money, I had a new idea. And so I immediately started like investing back into this new idea, which became Resilia. It paid off.
Right.
Right. So it definitely paid off. But yeah, I never thought about like, oh, I'm going to splurge and do this or splurge and do that. You know, I did buy things like, oh, even before that, I had bought like my condo. And then I started thinking about, oh, well, now I can buy like another house where I was another city that I was working heavily in. And so it allowed me to do things like that. But to your point about, oh, did you have time to spend it or blow it or all of those other things? I don't think I was necessarily, again, like conscious of, oh, am I going to take this money and do X, Y, and Z with it? I already knew that I wanted to start this other company. I needed money to invest in that. I wanted to ensure that I could work in this other city comfortably. And so I was making like very more like logical moves, but not necessarily logical of how I think about logic today. And so that was like at one level. Now that I built Resilia and I have like, to be honest, more wealth, now I think about it completely different.
And how so? Like, how do you think about it today than you thought about it back then?
I'll give you an example. Okay. And I'm gonna share this because I think it's important. Life insurance. I mean, I never thought about life insurance other than life insurance that I got as just like in my company, right? So maybe like $100,000, $200,000, maybe $1 million, whatever policy you have via the insurance that you get through the company. But I never understood that you had certain people that because of your salary, that you could essentially get X amount of millions of dollars in life insurance and pay a fee monthly to have that life insurance. So that if you pass away, when you pass away, you can leave $8, $12 million to your family.
Wow.
Like, I never thought about that, you know, early on in entrepreneurship. And those are the things that I'm planning for today that I was not planning for yesterday with my financial advisor, my wealth manager. And these are things that we just don't talk about,
yeah.
Right? And maybe, obviously, we want to talk about my household because nobody's making type of salaries where they can take out $1 million life insurance policies.
Right. No, and that's a fact. And it's funny because growing up, like, my family, we lived in this poor neighborhood, but I went to the same school as, like, all the rich white kids. And this was a conversation that was happening at their dinner table. When I'd be invited for dinner, I'm like, I have no idea what they're talking about. Now, looking back, I'm like, oh, that's what they were sort of saying. But again, they came from different circumstances. You know, both their parents were entrepreneurs, right? So these things, and they were running successful businesses. So these things were always discussed and talked about. So as you are learning more, you're now making different decisions.
Yeah.
Right? Not necessarily better because it's what you know right now, right? Even back then, they were still good decisions, but it was just different than where you are today. And the wealth that you've been able to build and the information you've been able to receive over time as well.
Yeah, I think it's like, how do you use your money, irregardless of how much it is, to make money for you, right? And to like leave behind something that doesn't rely on you working yourself to death, right? And so initially it's like, oh, if I want to leave $12 million to my family, I have to go out and make $12 million. I have to go out and invest where they can liquidate something that would get them $12 million. Or I can pay about $1,100 a month and get this policy.
Right.
That would do the same thing.
Listen. I know a lot of my friends are like, they talk about this, like this is how a lot of, you know, families built wealth, right? Yeah. Through life insurance policies and et cetera. That's really interesting because, you know, you're someone that I see, you know, someone that I look up to and what you're doing and pursuing. Like when you were up, you betted on something else, right?
Yeah.
And most people wouldn't do that. Most people would stick to what they know. They stay in their comfort zone and they'll double down, right?
Yeah.
They'll double down in it. So you were in your first business, you made money through doing marketing, brand development, for
PR,
PR for companies, not individuals.
So I started off individuals.
Okay.
And then I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Wait, why?
Oh, no, I can't do it anymore, y'all.
What happened? What happened with individuals? Was it the money or like the personality?
It was all of it.
Okay.
It was all of it. And I have so many entrepreneurs in business who just are starting out and they're just working. You know, sometimes you have to take what you can get and you build upon it. And I know we have this big thing, you know, get what you worth, what are you worth exactly? Let's quantify what that is. Your worth with people around you will pay ultimately.
Correct.
And when I was first coming out the gate, you know, I was charging super small retainers and doing all of this work. And it was generally for like individuals that was helping support their work or like small business owners. And I mean, they work you like a dog for that little money.
It's their Hail Mary.
Yes.
Right?
They think we're going to save them.
Correct,
right.
Correct.
And I think that's unfortunately not what a consultant is signed up to do. And I think that that dynamic probably needs to change and hurts particularly a lot of consultants of like color, right? Mm. Because we also have that dynamic. We want to help people. We just want to help people. So we're always doing a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, not getting paid for it. And so I wanted to break out of that.
Right.
And so that's why I moved over to just working with large companies, government, right? Yeah. They might pay slow, but they're going to pay.
Right.
And then technology, right? So tech, delivering service through software.
So what made you say, like, I think most entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, even like people listening in right now, they're working with other individuals and services, or they're creating their own products in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
What made you expand your mindset and say, wait a second, governments, you know, have contracts, mm-hmm. companies have contracts. What made you go that route? And since you went that route, what advice do you have for, you know, that individual that's offering services
yeah.
currently and not at that level? What would you advise
yeah.
them to do?
And you might, and here's the thing, some people, it might work for them, right? And you may be comfortable with what you make, what you bring home, and you may also like the relationships you have with your clientele. For the most part, I did not.
Okay.
Because they were very high profile in many instances. They were very, like, with that high maintenance, very demanding, you know, divas, devos. It was a lot. And I made a conscious decision to resign my contracts. Usually people got to get kicked out of the contract. No, I was like, I no longer want to be in this relationship. And I'm resigning my contract, right? And people felt a certain type of way about that because they're like, no, you're part of my team. I need you to be here on my team. I'm like, no, not anymore. I'm moving on. And so I give, like, the feedback that I would give to other people is to think about what does your timeline look like and what do you want for your business and what do you want for yourself? What do you want for your sanity? Because sometimes just dealing with individual people, I was going to go crazy if I stayed in the situation that I was in because it just wasn't healthy, right? It wasn't healthy to be like running around with people waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, why? It's
right,
just not
right,
healthy.
Right.
And so I made a conscious decision to begin to move out of that space and to begin to align other opportunities like in government contracting, going for contracts with larger companies and corporations, who, you know, they want to see what you're doing and they expect for you to deliver, but they definitely not calling you at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
They definitely not texting you, asking you like where stuff, you know, is. And I got into government contracting. You know, the government is essentially is the largest buyer in the world, right? And so the government buys more than anyone. They buy everything from toilet tissue to toothpaste to hair products. To digital media, you name it, they buy everything. And I decided after attending a Black Enterprise conference and hearing a woman talk about breaking into government contracting. And it's kind of funny because she was like, oh, people who are in the private sector want to break into government contracting. People in government contracting want the private dollars, right? I wanted both.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I went after.
So that was your early on, you know, you're hearing someone speak about it and maybe someone's listening in right now and they're like, wait a second, I never thought of that before. And so is there a specific resource that you would, you know, advise that person to go look towards if they're looking at, okay, what are the contracts or in terms of finding government contracts?
Yeah, I mean, you can find, first of all, you have to figure out what it is you offer, right? Because the government contract world, you will go down a rabbit hole because it's so big. There's so many departments. You can do government contracting at the federal level, at the state level, at your local level, with your city, right? And so you have to figure out, where do you want to start? And I actually started, ironically, at the state level. Then I got a contract with the federal government, and then came back to local government municipalities. So it's not like you have to start at the city level and go up. Start where you feel like you have a entree in, perhaps, or where you feel most comfortable starting with, right? And so there are a lot of books on government contracting. You know, go to your local economic development office. And so every state has an economic development office. In Louisiana, it's called LED, Louisiana Economic Development Office. And inside the economic development office, they have a small business division. Find who runs a small business division and go and schedule a meeting or call with that person. And they will tell you everything you need to know about government contracting for free.
Listen. No, that's really good. And I think a lot of people sometimes don't know where to start. So giving them that advice, for that person listening in, driving to work, and they're like, wait a second, I'm going to do that during my lunch break. I think that's, you know, really important. And thank you for sharing that, because most people keep things close to chest. So, you know, really, really appreciate that. And I know the audience will as well. So Savitra, you went from this business, your first business, you then go transition, you build a second business in the area you weren't strong in to begin with. You hire the right people.
Not at first, but eventually.
Eventually. You hire the right people. And you said hiring is like a superpower of yours now. You know, what tips do you have around that?
It's always a work in progress.
What tips do you have around hiring that sort of helped you so far?
So something I always tell people is that people have been hiring and doing this for a very long time, right? I think oftentimes we'll hire people because we just fall in love with the candidate. We're like, oh man, this person can come in. They're going to be a game changer. Mm. This is the person I've been missing. And then they come in and you're like, this is not the person I've been missing. In fact, this person is just running up the bill.
Correct. Listen.
And now how do I get rid of this person? I just hired this person. Maybe they left their job to come and work with me. All these different dynamics come into play. You got to cut all that out to begin with. And then also when you're interviewing people, get you like an advisory board, or get, if you don't have like a lot of employees, maybe it's just you, it's your first hire, get you someone else who has been around the block, or get you someone that might have been in HR. You know, this could be like a friend of the family, you know, a professor, whoever, someone that has like been around the block before, and have those people, at least two other people, interview that candidate, right? Don't you just interview a candidate and make a decision. That's something that I had to learn myself, is to get other feedback from others and say like, oh, what did you think about that candidate? Because oftentimes you'll find that they caught something that you missed, or they caught something that you need to go back and double down on.
Wow. No, and I think that's really good. A lot of us, you know, even the solopreneurs listening in, or people running successful companies, hiring is like one of the hardest, you know, and the most challenging and the most expensive, not only time-wise, but also like capital intensive as well. So hopefully that was, you know, really helpful. Find an advisory board, or find other people that could also conduct the interviews outside of just you. Because it is, some people interview really well.
Yeah.
And you fall in love with them. You're like, this is it. This is the one. And then they start after the first 7 days, 14 days. You're like, wait a second. Maybe I didn't hire the right person. Why didn't I hire the right person? You know, am I even the right person to interview that individual to
That's
know that they would have been great, right? And so I started looking inward and say, you know what, maybe I wasn't the right person to interview for this specific role. That's why I missed it. But at the end of the day, like when you're hiring, it all falls back on your shoulder, right? Whether they're successful in their role or they're not successful, you know, you signed off on it, right?
Yeah.
At the end of the day. So what you're trying to do essentially, you're trying to get, you know, people that maybe have experience in that space, or people that can help you interview, so that way you're not the only one making this decision. You're having an advisory board as well. Yeah. So you got good at hiring. Now you're building out a team. How big is your team now? Are you able to say?
We're currently at about 44 people. We'll be at like 56 by the end of the year.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
We're constantly hiring. So go check us out, Resilia. look down the recruitment tab. We got some jobs there. We're always hiring.
Listen, she's trying to give y'all jobs out here. This is unscripted. Trying to give y'all jobs. No, that's amazing. And Resilia today, from the vision you first started, how has it changed? Like, what would you say, is Resilia today versus when you first started, and the vision that you thought, you know, you would have for it?
Yeah. So when we first started, we were doing something really simple, and that was just helping nonprofits start, right? So going through the incorporation exemption process of becoming a nonprofit. We've clearly completely expanded since then. And where the real scale in our company exists today is actually on our funder platform. And so those are with these large enterprise companies, which make up roughly about a $3.8 billion market. And so for us, we went from having, a little bit under $1 billion market to now in total close to $5 billion market, right? So the vision expansion of the company has been immense. And it also reflects of like, how do we go from this 8-figure company to now 9-figure company, et cetera. And so we're able to show that trajectory.
And for those that are not familiar, how does Resilia actually make its money? Like, if you could simplify
subscription. So say you are a client of ours, like an Oxfam America or like a Goldman Sachs. Say you fund these different projects or nonprofits across the country, across the world, you essentially are paying a subscription seat. So you're buying a seat for like $2,000 a year for each of the organizations or initiatives that you actually fund. And so a customer, a large enterprise customer of ours, can pay anywhere from $40,000 a year to hundreds of thousands, million dollars a year. Whereas a nonprofit individual seat may be paying like $1,000 a year on our platform.
So yeah, they're making money out here. If you're wondering, I hope you don't wonder no more. And so this is, been really great. And again, and I know we could sit here and talk all day, because there's so much, I think, that you could, the wisdom that you have. And Savitra, remind me again, you are either one of or the only woman from New Orleans that's raised double digits in VC funding. Is that correct?
So in Louisiana, I've raised the most of any woman founder in VC, in venture capital in the state.
Y'all heard that? I need to drop a clue bomb over here. No, just kidding.
But we do a number. We got to get that number to change, right? Because I'm always like, man, you're first. I was like the one of very few Black women who've raised over $1 million. Now I'm one of very few who've raised over $10 million, right? Mm. And so I think we continue to go. But the goal is to bring more people into the fold, so we don't have to continue to be the only one.
And how are you doing that? Because I know you, and I know every time you move ahead, you're always looking, you're turning around and trying to help other people. So how are you doing that? Are you doing that by being more visible? Like, what would you say you're doing to be part of that solution?
Yeah, so I'm a big believer of lifting as you climb, because I don't think that as a Black woman and founder, and even Black people in general, we don't have the time to waste to go all the way to the top of the ladder and say, all right, I made it. Let me send that ladder back down, because you're going to look back down. Nobody's going to be there to send it to. So we have to, even though it may be like a burden on our shoulders, we have to like lift as we climb. And so I do that a number of different ways. I give out so many free resources. I try to respond to emails when people hit me up. I try to respond to like quick chats with individuals. I wrote a book. So I'm always thinking of like, how can I like give back to the ecosystem, and how can I deliver the knowledge that I did not have, right, when I needed it?
Is it uncomfortable being the only one? you know, sometimes in these rooms, as you are right now, as you're trying to help other people get into these rooms, it, has it been uncomfortable for you or have...
It used to be.
Okay.
Like back in the day, right? It used to be uncomfortable. Like, oh man, I'm like the only black person in this room again. But now I come in taking notes. All right, I got to bring this back. I got to bring this back to the table. Because a lot of times it's like, oh, how can we go get it? You know, we have the saying, everybody says, oh, don't worry about sitting at someone else's table. Build your own table. I'm all about building your own table. But no, I want to sit at this table too with you because you've been doing this for... You've been running this country for X amount of years. You have all this capital, this resources. I want to be at your table too, so I can go back and bring resources to all my other people, and particularly when you have the power, right? Mm. When you have power and control. And so I'm a big believer of definitely building your own table, but also, no, we need to sit at their tables too.
Right, right. No, I agree with that. Listen, I definitely agree with that. And so where do you see your brand going, and where do you see Resilia going? Because as you're building this company and you're getting more visibility, it's almost two entities, right? There's Savitra.
It has kind of become that.
and so first question is, how has visibility impacted your day-to-day? Because you are being written on these Forbes article, right? So how has the visibility, being in the forefront, mm-hmm. what's that like? Living your day to day?
It could be a lot sometimes, right? So I think it's definitely like a big responsibility, but it also has opened up opportunities, right? And so I think that that is what visibility powers, right? It allows you to open up opportunities. But, you know, people are very successful without having any presence online or anywhere.
You did that for a long time.
I did that for a long time. And I think that now I try to step into it, but still try to remain, have a level of like privacy as well. Like even like this year, for example, when you talk about like brands, for the longest, I would turn down brand partnerships, right? Because I'm like, no, you know, I got to focus on business. I don't want people to be like, oh, you're distracted. And this year I was like, you know what? I'm going to do a few brand partnerships. And that has been pretty good for me.
Right, right. Listen. No, and I'm glad. And again, I think you're running two entities, right? Like your own brand. And without, again, you're not even focused on your own brand.
No.
Like you're building
it
this company.
Comes to me. It does.
And it comes to you. And so where do you see your company going now as you look ahead and all the work that you've been doing, the hiring that you've been doing this mm-hmm. last year? Where do you see that going?
So we're going to continue to hire. We've actually been hiring for 18 consecutive months, nonstop, right? And that's not going to stop. So again, go to LinkedIn, check out the jobs, Arizona, we're hiring. But, you know, as true to most companies at our stage, we'll probably have a financing round in the future and raise like more capital to continue to help us scale and grow. You know, we have big goals, so we have to kind of move and maneuver like a company that got big goals.
So in the beginning of the interview, you said, you know, your first business, you know, at that point, you wanted to help your mom, you know, like that was your biggest driver. What would you say is the biggest driver for you now?
So I definitely feel like my biggest driver is leaving a legacy even through my mom, right? And so like one of my goals is to build a new library and name my mom in our hometown, right, of Hammond, Louisiana. And so I think I still have very similarly fit goals, but they're much larger now. But still driven by, you know, how can I like leave something behind that doesn't like die when I do. And I know that's like, that could be heavy too, right? Trying to accomplish that can be heavy. So I'm conscious of like just also trying to allow like just being like happiness be enough, because you always add something else to the plate when you're an entrepreneur and when you're always like looking for the next big thing.
Would you say you're currently happy? Are you in a state of happiness?
Yeah, minus this Hurricane Ida situation. Yeah. I think that, I feel like I'm happy, right? And I think that that's important to note, because it doesn't mean like, oh, next week or 2 weeks or 2 months from now, I might be in a state where I'm not happy, right? But I think that it's about finding what makes you like feel good, what makes you feel good about yourself, what you're doing, people around you, the work around you, and ensuring that you stay in those places and spaces. But you know, I think the journey is, it's a roller coaster ride.
Right.
And I think there's like this backlash recently to, oh, I don't want to hear from people. I don't want to learn from people who've had hard times anymore. I don't want to be resilient anymore. I don't want to have to, I'm like, okay, people, right. Jesus Christ. Right. It's like, I get it. We shouldn't, as people know, we shouldn't have to have all these things we have to go through to come out and have success on the other side, right? Can we have just like a normal path and have things easier? Yes, but you still experience a loss in life. And you're never going to get past experiencing loss. It doesn't have to be materialistic, right? It can be a person. It can be, you know, someone that was close to you. You're grieving that person. And so I think that you have to ensure that you're in a healthy space mentally, and even physically, to be able to weather the storm and come back out of it yourself and come back out of it happy.
No, I'm glad to hear that, because, you know, this is, you know, the last 2 years have been, you know, wild. So
yeah, man.
Being able to find happiness, you know, within
2022,
that.
Come on. It was a break.
Honestly. Now, I meant to ask you earlier, is there any lessons you learned from your mom that you carry to this day? Because she seems to be a biggest motivation and your fuel, and I never met your mom, but I always see you talking about her on Instagram, and I'm guessing she would have a lot of the characteristics and qualities as you do. You have a really big heart, and you mentioned that you got your heart from your mom. So is there anything that maybe she shared with you or you carry to this day that, you know, that you reflect upon a lot in your journey?
Yeah, I mean, it was things that my mother said, but it was a lot of things of what she did. Like, my mother truly like led by example of being like very selfless and like just very like caring human being, right? And so very thoughtful. And so those are some of the things that I feel I have taken from her more than even words. But, you know, my mom used to say things like, you know, live to fight another day, because, you know, I'm so passionate, right? I'm like, oh, I need to take over the world. She'd be like, live to fight another day. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. Not every battle is mine. And so it's things like that that still stay with me, that my mother share with me. And that's why I always say, like, even in death, she continues to give me life.
No, that's really good. That's really good. And thank you for sharing that, too. Now, we're going to get ready to wrap this up. I definitely want to give a shout out to, again, Savitra, because you wrote 2 books.
I did.
In the last 24 months?
No,
3 years. Okay. Last 24 months? No, I'm just kidding.
Maybe even 4, to be honest.
And so your first book was Solid Ground. Right? Yeah. Solid Ground. And your first company was Solid Ground Innovation. I see what you did there.
You know what? That's so true. I never even lined that, but you're right. It sure was.
And then that was how you built your first business. You bootstrapped to 7 figures. Mm-hmm. Now your second book, which came out recently, is called Resilient. And that's from, yes, you guessed it. Her company name is Resilia. And so, did you know you were going to name this Resilient?
No, actually, I went through so many different names before I got to Resilient. And it's not even really about, it definitely has a lot about Resilia, about my story, building Resilia, but just my story in general, my thought process and what I kind of went through building Resilia. And even some of my thoughts around like wealth and other topics about just building wealth.
Yeah. And, you know, 2 really, really good books. I literally told Savitra that I keep copies of her books in my apartment. And whenever people come visit, I literally will give them, you know, I'll, you know, write her signature. No, I'm just kidding. I literally give her books away to friends, family that come visit. You know, you're truly an inspiration to so many people, and it really starts with your heart. You know, you're always looking to give, and I know recently, you know, Resilia decided to start a grant giving out $25,000 to help those and the recovery of Hurricane Ida. So, you know, this is a really true testament to who you are. And, you know, when you give, you know, I think you always get 10, 100 times back in return, you know? Okay. And so this has been really, really good. This has been a really good conversation. I know, you know, you always come through for me in a clutch. You always come through for me in a clutch, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, and for those listening in, let me first tell you how I even met Savitra. And we wrap this up. But I met Savitra a few years ago. I think it was 2019. And I was at South by Southwest. I see her walking in, and I never met her in person, but I saw her online. I saw other people speak about her. And so I was like, oh, I gotta go meet her. So I'm sitting a few rows behind her. And, you know, I'm not gonna like, hey, Savitra, like, you know, down the auditorium, because she don't even know who I am. I'm still, no one really knows me. I'm like, you know, people still think I'm somebody's camera guy at that point. And so I DM her and I was like, hey, it's Abu, but she didn't check her phone. So I actually didn't meet her in 2019. And then fast forward, I met you maybe later in the year. So later in the year, I'm in DC. I see she's in DC. And I reach out there. I was like, oh, I'm in DC. And she's like, oh, you're in DC. Let's meet up. Mind you, I'm literally on my way out of DC.
He said he was in DC, not on a train out of DC.
I was literally right there at the train station getting ready to leave out of DC. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm still here. Like, yeah, let's meet up. So I literally missed my train. I go back and we meet up for the first time. And I thought it'd be like a quick, like 5 minutes. And we ended up talking about everything. And I was like, man, like, here's someone that they get me. Like, this is, you know, you talk about building a tribe, building a community. And what she was doing was just so amazing. And here she was, like, deflecting and being super humble all the time. And that's the first time I told her. I was like, oh, did you ever hear the story about Mark Cuban and Michael Dell? And they met at this bar, and they knew that they were going to build these, you know, amazing companies and these amazing things. Whoever has a higher net worth, that's Savitra, basically. And that's definitely him. That was the start of the relationship. And since that moment, like, and I won't even tell y'all the London story, but since that moment, Savitra's always been in my corner, always supporting me. And, you know, I'd do anything for Savitra. I literally told her I could be her bodyguard, but I don't know how helpful I'll be. And I truly, truly appreciate you joining us today on this show, on this podcast. Now, where can the audience find out more about you?
So you can find out, really, just go to my website, SavitraWilson.com. Everything's there, you know.
And you also have a podcast. What's your podcast that they can look up?
Yeah, so my podcast is called From Solid Ground to Resilient.
Okay. Anything else you have you want to shout out?
Yeah, you can find me on, you know, social media, Savitra Wilson. Again, we're hiring at resilient.com, so check that out as well. But thank you for having me on and for being the person that always shows up for not only me, but your friends, your family, and always doing the most, right? Because he was doing the most. I'm like, but why would you do that? Like, go to London. Don't cancel your trips. Get on the train. We'll catch up another time.
Right.
But he's so intentional, and I appreciate that about you.
No, I appreciate that. So thank you, everyone, for listening in. Feel free to reach out to Savitra. Again, she's on Instagram at Savitra Wilson. Go to her website, SavitraWilson.com, to find out more information. And again, she's hiring, so make sure to go check out Resilia. I believe it's Resilia.com.
Yes.
Resilia.com. That's Resilia.com to look at job opportunities as well. Thank you. Thank you so much. And I will see you all during the next episode. All right. Thank you for joining us at the Powered AF podcast. Make sure to visit our website and make sure to follow our podcast anywhere you listen to the podcast to make sure you never miss a show. And please, 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 if you enjoyed this episode and this show, please make sure to leave us a review. It really, really does help. And last thing, if you're interested in this freebie that I just released, I want you to check this out. Recently, I put together a free online training on how to 10x your sales online. This is for business owners who are struggling with making consistent sales online. Whether you run a product or service-based business, this is the perfect training for you. The free training is still up, and you can access it by going to poweryourlaunch.com/pod.
Again, poweryourlaunch.com/pod. That's P-O-D. All right. Thanks again for listening in. I'll see you during our next show.